Now we're going to move on into the subject of teleology, the teleological argument. Telos just means purpose or end, and logos meaning study or word, the study of purpose. So let's move into our second line of evidence here, the teleological argument, or the organization of the universe. Not just that the universe exists, but that it is organized to be life-permitting. Life-permitting. Without the physical laws finely tuned at such an incommensurable degree, human life would be impossible. I'd like to read you several quotes from atheistic and agnostic scientists who just supported what I just said. Again, this is not creation science. This is not Christians coming up with this. This is secular science discovering these facts about nature. Here's Richard Dawkins, an atheistic biologist. This is in his book, The God Delusion. I'm sure you see where he stands on things. He writes on page 169, physicists have calculated that if the laws and constants of physics had been even slightly different, the universe would have developed in such a way that life would have been impossible. Different physicists have put it different ways, but the conclusion is almost always the same. So if the laws of nature were just slightly off, we would not have life. John Barrow from Oxford writes this: over many years, there had grown up a collection of largely unpublished results revealing a series of mysterious coincidences between the numerical values of the fundamental constants of nature. The possibility of our own existence seems to hinge precariously upon these coincidences. In other words, if these things didn't converge just right, they call it the Goldilocks effect. Not too hot, not too cold, just right. Or not too strong, not too soft, just right. If the laws of nature weren't perfectly aligned in a mysterious coincidence, according to Barrow, we would not exist. He continues to write, the fact that so many of nature's most important creations owe their gross size and structure to the mysterious values of the constants of nature places our own existence in a new and illuminating perspective. We can see how the conditions necessary for our own existence are contingent upon the values taken by the constants. At first, one might imagine that a change in the value of a constant would simply shift the size of everything a little, but that there would still exist stars and atoms. Do you see what he's saying? Maybe if we made the force of gravity just a little bit weaker, well, maybe everything would just be a little bit looser. Or different fundamental forces of physics, if we just shifted them a little, well, maybe things would just be bigger or smaller, that sort of thing. However, he writes, this turns out to be too naive a view. It transpires that there exist a number of very unusual coincidences regarding the values of particular combinations of the constants of nature, which are necessary conditions for our own existence. Were the fine structure constant to differ by roughly 1% from its actual value, then the structure of stars would be dramatically different. Indeed, there is every reason to suspect we would not be here to discuss the matter. If it was just off by 1% on this one physical constant. Agnostic physicist Stephen Hawking, this is in his brand new book, The Grand Design, he writes this: the strengths of the strong nuclear force and the electromagnetic force that are made to order for our existence. Most of the fundamental constants in our theories appear fine-tuned in the sense that if they were altered by only modest amounts, the universe would be qualitatively different. Notice the language. These constants are finely tuned, and in many cases, writes Hawking, unsuitable for the development of life. For example, if the other nuclear force, the weak force, were much weaker in the early universe, all the hydrogen in the cosmos would have been turned to helium, and hence there would be no normal stars. Think about that. Could we have life without burning stars or rocky planets? If it were much stronger, writes Hawking, exploding supernovas would not eject their outer envelopes and hence would fail to seed interstellar space with the heavy elements planets require to foster life. If protons were 0.2% heavier, they would decay into neutrons, destabilizing atoms. Hawking writes, the laws of nature form a system that is extremely fine-tuned, and very little in physical law can be altered without destroying the possibility of the development of life as we know it. Could he be any more clear? If this was tweaked just a little bit, we wouldn't have life. Hawking writes, were it not for a series of startling coincidences, do you see the same language? Barrow said that they're mysterious coincidences. He says startling coincidences. In the precise details of physical law, it seems, humans and similar life forms would never have come into being. What can we make of these coincidences, writes Hawking? Our universe and its laws appear to have a design that is tailor-made to support us, and if we are to exist, leaves little room for alteration. That is not easily explained and raises the natural question of why it is that way. So in Hawking's own words, it appears to be cosmically designed. If the laws were off, we wouldn't exist. Now, Hawking's book, The Grand Design, is a 250-page treatise on how God doesn't exist and God didn't design these physical laws. Now, I'm going to wait to explain how Hawking accounts for these laws until the end of the teaching. But just for now, know, Hawking doesn't believe that a designer did this. His whole book is about how there is no grand design. I'll give you his explanation later. Martin Rees, an agnostic cosmologist, very reputable, in his book, Just Six Numbers, writes this. These six numbers constitute a recipe for a universe. Moreover, the outcome is sensitive to their values. If any one of them were to be untuned, same language, there would be no stars and no life. Now, Rees is a cosmologist, physicist. He's just focusing on six of these physical constants and laws. Well, here's his explanation. Is this tuning just a brute fact, a coincidence? Or is it the providence of a benign creator? I take the view that it is neither. This guy's not a believer in God. He's agnostic. Rees writing on the N constant, this number measures the strengths of the electrical forces that hold atoms together, divided by the force of gravity between them. It's a mathematical explanation of this law, this force. If N, this force, had a few less zeros, only a short-lived miniature universe could exist. No creatures could grow larger than insects, and there would be no time for biological evolution. Notice, this argument circumvents the argument from neo-Darwinism. If these laws were off, there would have been no possibility of Darwinian evolution. There'd be no feasible ability to have biological life at all. Rees writes, we have no theory that tells us the value of N, this force. All we know is that nothing as complex as humankind could have emerged if N were much less than, and I am not reading that number, 10 to the 36th power, a 10 with 36 zeros next to it. Writing on the epsilon constant, it's one of his other constants, it defines how firmly atomic nuclei bind together and how the atoms on Earth were made. Its value controls the power from the sun and, more sensitively, how stars transmute hydrogen, blah, blah, blah. If epsilon were 0.006 or 0.008, we could not exist. Somehow, by providence, it's 0.007. It's exactly right. Rees writes, on the omega constant, the cosmic number measures the amount of material in our universe, galaxies, diffuse gas, dark matter. If this ratio were too high relative to a particular critical value, the universe would have collapsed long ago. Had it been too low, no galaxies, stars would have been formed. The initial expansion speed seems to have been finely tuned. Well, I'm sure you get the idea. None of these guys are believers in God, and yet these are the facts that are presented to us from modern physics. Well, number one, what about chance? Maybe we just got really lucky. We hit the cosmic jackpot, is the way Paul Davies puts it in his book. Can chance explain these constants? Can chance explain these constants? Well, here's Roger Penrose. This is from his massive book, The Road to Reality, A Complete Guide to the Laws of the Universe. This is what he writes on page 762. He says that the uniqueness of the Big Bang singularity is 1 in 10 billion raised to the 123rd power. That's how unique the Big Bang singularity was. If it had been off by even a little bit, we wouldn't have life. Paul Davies, this is from God and the New Physics, he writes this. Had the explosion of the Big Bang differed in strength at the outset by only one part in 10 to the 60th power, the universe we now perceive would not exist. 10 to the 60th power. Well, I said earlier that the amount of protons, neutrons, and electrons in the universe is 10 to the 80th power. All the subatomic particles added together is 10 to the 80th. That's 10 with 80 zeros behind it. He's saying that this has to be finely tuned to 10 in the 60th power, something quite less, but 10 with 60 zeros after it. Davies writes, to give some meaning to these numbers, suppose you wanted to fire a bullet at a 1-inch target on the other side of the observable universe, 20 billion light years away. Your aim would have to be accurate to that same part in 10 to the 60th power. So how easy would it be for you to hit a 1-inch target in this room with a blindfold on? Pretty hard. Now, what if the size of the room was actually the observable universe? That's how lucky you would have to be. Now, if a bullet got dragged to that point, wouldn't you think that there was foul play involved? That there was a cosmic magnet pulling that bullet in that direction? Hugh Ross, this is the only Christian I'm going to quote. Okay, and I'm not quoting him to get the scientific facts. I'm only quoting him because he explains, gives an illustration of how incomprehensible these stats really are, these chances are. This is from his book, The Creator and the Cosmos, which is a terrific book. Ross writes, one part in 10 to the 37th power, 10 with 37 zeros after it, is such an incredibly sensitive balance that it's hard to visualize. No kidding. The following analogy might help. Cover the entire North American continent in dimes all the way up to the moon, a height of about 239,000 miles. You're just looking down at the Earth, and the dimes are flooding up towards you. Okay, where's he going with this? In comparison, the money to pay for the U.S. federal government debt would cover 1 square mile less than 2 feet deep with dimes. I don't know. This is written in 2001. Lots happened between now and then, but you get the point. Next, pile dimes from here to the moon on a billion other continents, the same as North America. Wait a minute. Okay, the entire continental U.S., all the way up to the moon in dimes. Now do that on a billion other planets, exactly the same way. Paint one dime red and mix it into the billions of piles of dimes. Blindfold a friend and ask him to pick out one dime. The odds that he'll pick the red dime are 10 to the 37th power. Now, wait a minute. That's 10 to the 37th power. Davies just said that the expansion rate of the universe needs to be finely tuned to one part in 10 to the 60th power. Well, that's like about double, right? 10 to the 37th, 10 to the 60th, that's double. Wrong. 10 to the 38th power is 10 times that statistic. 10 to the 39th, 100 times that statistic. 10 to the 60th power, it's just incredibly more improbable than you could even imagine. Okay, not only does chance not explain this, explain just one physical law or constant, but you can't just explain one. No, that'd be too easy. 10 to the 60th power. You've got to explain several dozen constants. And they all have to be finely tuned to be exactly right for life. Here's the way Davies describes it. I'm reading a lot out of these books here. I know it's kind of difficult to keep up, but I'm reading so you realize we're not making this up. He writes in his book, The Goldilocks Enigma, he says that there have to be roughly 30 knobs, is the way he calls it, that need to be finely tuned for life to exist. It's not just enough to have one or two or 10, that there's actually 30 that need to be precisely coinciding with one another. You can see why Barrow and Hawking and Rees would call these mysterious coincidences, startling coincidences. They all have to be coinciding together. So we could think about it like this. Okay, here's one constant. The speed of expansion from the Big Bang. I'm going to give Alan Guth's explanation. He says it's one part in 10 to the 55th power. Okay, Davy says it's 10 to the 60th power. You can see there is some wiggle room between these. Let's just go with the conservative estimate, 10 to the 55th power, speed of the expansion of the Big Bang. Okay, then you've also got to line up the strength of gravity. That's one part out of 10 to the 40th power. Okay, it's got to be perfectly lined up together. Not only is it right on this line, right on that line too. Okay, now let's add in the mass of the universe, 10 to the 59th power. Then the ratio of electrons to protons, 10 to the 37th power. Then the cosmological constant. Oh, this one's big. 10 to the 120th power. All in all, you need to have somewhere between 30 to 50 constants. Let's just go with the conservative estimate. Let's just say it was 10. Let's just say it was 20. They say it's anywhere between 30 and 50. How could all of these things line up just right for life? Well, number three, everyone agrees on these figures. Now, I'm kind of exaggerating there a little bit. There are some people who disagree. But the consensus, the top dogs, that Martin Rees, John Barrow, Stephen Hawking, the top men and women in this field all agree on these figures. Now, Alan Guth might say it's 10 to the 55th. And Paul Davies might say it's 10 to the 60th. But it sure ain't 10 to the 5th. These are incredibly astronomical coincidences that we're seeing. The only skeptic I've been able to find that really disagrees with these numbers is Victor Stenger. He has a new book called The Fallacy of Fine-Tuning. The only thing he really argues is, well, if one constant was changed, then the other constants might change with it. And really, these constants aren't as big as some guys like Hawking and Rees and Barrow say, but they're a little bit smaller. Even if he's right, the odds here are just incommensurably great, astronomically great. And he's one of the greatest skeptics in this field. So Stenger is kind of the sore thumb in the whole community. I just really disagree with his view. And it's very suspicious that he's what he's publishing there. But you can see the rest of these guys all agree on these figures. But I think it's fair at least to say there's one guy out there that's kind of on the periphery. And I'm sure there's some others. But what I'm saying is the majority of science agrees on these figures. These figures are held, of course, not by creation scientists, but by atheistic and agnostic physicists. The facts aren't disputed. It's the interpretation of the facts that's disputed. Again, it's the same thing as with the Big Bang. We're not saying that we disagree on the science. We agree on the science. We're saying we disagree on how to interpret those facts. We agree on the existence of these laws. That's not being disagreed upon. It's their explanation. We all observe the same things looking out into the cosmos. The question is, how do we explain what we're observing? Well, again, which view best explains the fine-tuning of the universe? Theism or atheism? Which worldview has more explanatory power? Well, number four, the cause behind these laws would need to be incommensurably, immeasurably intelligent. If they could finely tune physical law in this capacity, whatever the cause is, it would have to be incredibly intelligent to do that, and powerful. Finally, these scientific discoveries are powerful and persuasive evidence for God. Now, if you don't believe that this is good evidence for God, then you have a problem on your hands. And the name of your problem is Anthony Flew. Many of you have probably never heard of Anthony Flew. If you were an atheist or an agnostic, you would definitely know who this man is. Anthony Flew was the leading philosophical defender of atheism in the 20th century. He was the top dog. Flew wrote scores of books on atheism, philosophy of religion, debated all over the Western world on how atheism is true, spoke in universities, was a professor, sat underneath C.S. Lewis in his Socratic club back in the 40s, scoffed at Lewis, thought it was ridiculous to believe in the existence of God, came up with some of the best arguments against God. The theory of falsification was developed by Anthony Flew. Here's Flew debating William Lane Craig. It's back in 1998. In the bottom left-hand corner, you can see Flew debating Gary Habermas, a philosopher and historian. Here's a splattering of some of the books that he wrote, Atheistic Humanism, Philosophy of Belief. Well, something changed in the early 2000s in Anthony Flew's life. For about a decade, Flew became buddies with Gary Habermas. They debated on the resurrection of Jesus Christ. They became friends. Gary Habermas and Anthony Flew would talk on the phone. They had a letter correspondence going back and forth. They became buddies. Well, eventually, Habermas was talking to Flew and came to realize that Flew's faith in atheism was starting to weaken. Finally, at one point, Habermas just said, "Are you sure that you still want to be an atheist?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm still sure." Well, eventually, in 2007, Flew came out on the scene and admitted that he had moved from atheism to belief in God. And he wrote the book, There Is a God, How the World's Most Notorious Atheist Changed His Mind. He came on kind of a symposium where it was kind of a radio show where he was about to talk, and Flew announced there, "Actually, I'm not here to argue against the intelligent design movement or fine-tuning or cosmology. I'm actually here to explain why I find that evidence persuasive. And why, if my earlier atheist colleagues had heard of this evidence, they would have found it persuasive as well." So there's his book in 2007, There Is a God. Well, this is what Flew writes in his book. "Since the early 1980s, I had begun to reconsider atheism. I confessed at that point that atheists have to be embarrassed by the contemporary cosmological consensus." Isn't that what we were saying? That the universe began with a bang. "For it seemed that the cosmologists were providing a scientific proof of what St. Thomas Aquinas contended could not be proved philosophically, namely, that the universe had a beginning." So the argument from cosmology was persuasive. He didn't find William Lane Craig's version very persuasive, but he found Richard Swinburne's version. Whatever, who cares? Well, he writes on page 88, "I now believe that the universe was brought into existence by an infinite intelligence. I believe that this universe's intricate laws manifest what scientists have called the mind of God. I must stress that my discovery of the divine has proceeded on a purely natural level, without any reference to supernatural phenomena. It has been an exercise in what is traditionally called natural theology." That's where you look out at nature and try and understand, discern what we can know about God from his creation. Flew writes, "It has had no connection with any of the revealed religions, nor do I claim to have any personal experience of God or any experience that may be called supernatural or miraculous. In short, my discovery of the divine has been a pilgrimage of reason and not faith. It is a hard fact that we live in a universe with certain laws and constants, and life would not have been possible if some of these laws and constants had been different. We still have to come to terms with the origin of the laws of nature, and the only viable explanation here is the divine mind." Well, you could imagine when Flew wrote this book, when he came out and said, "I'm actually a believer in God now," how the atheistic community responded. They moved in on him like a bleeding scuba diver in a shark tank. Okay. Every atheist on the block was saying he's in his 80s. He's lost his mind. He's elderly. He can't think straight. He's losing his memory. You can go online on infidels.org, is a website held by Richard Carrier. And he has three articles on how Anthony Flew has dementia. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's lost his mind. He's losing his memory. What's funny is Flew came back and wrote an article. Hey, I'm over here. I haven't lost my mind. All of my friends from my philosophy club, scholarly club, have written to me. I've responded to each one of them. I've responded to all of them privately. He wrote a 200-page book. He wrote it with this co-author. That's why they think he lost his mind, that he couldn't have written it on his own. Well, he was getting really old. He needed somebody to help him to do it. But he went out and gave talks, gave interviews. What I gave you this week was his interview with Gary Habermas, where Habermas' buddy interviewed him and kind of walked him through what he believes now. Read that interview. Read that interview. I've read that with a few guys. We could hardly get through it because the language is so difficult. The guy's vocabulary is through the roof. The guy is sharp as a tack, and he remained that way until the very end of his life. He died back in 2010 in April. Flew never did come to believe in Christ as far as we know. He died in April of 2010. He did not find the evidence for the resurrection persuasive. He had debated against it his whole life. However, he does say, of all the world miracles that have ever happened, the resurrection has far more evidence than any other. He found that to be an excellent miracle, but he still didn't believe in it. In fact, he gave one of his appendices in his book, There Is a God, to N.T. Wright, who is a famous historian who wrote an 800-page book on the resurrection. Flew said, I'm going to give N.T. Wright 20 pages to give his argument. I don't believe it, but I still think there's pretty good evidence that it's worth considering. So as far as we know, he never did come to believe in Christ. Yeah, up here. The question is, isn't modern science constantly changing in the sense that you go from Newton now to Heisenberg to these more updated explanations of these physical laws? I guess I would say, like in all different fields of knowledge, our knowledge is never perfect. It's never exhaustive, but it is true. And so we're moving closer to truth in all these different areas. If we didn't believe that we are actually moving closer toward an objective truth, then we would dispel all pursuits of knowledge. And so with history, science, philosophy even, we're getting closer and closer to the truth. So when you look at quantum physics versus Newtonian physics, okay, they're contradictory on some level. What physicists are looking for is a grand theory of everything to explain all these fundamental forces and how they all coincide together. However, in their own area, for example, Newtonian physics being very far reaching, gravity, large bodies of matter and energy pulling each other, pushing, those sort of things, those things have relatively stayed the same. Whereas on the quantum level, we're discovering new, different things. So I wouldn't say that quantum physics completely abrogated or got rid of Newtonian physics, but it's getting into another area on a subatomic level. So I wouldn't say that it's completely dispelling it, but entering into new areas that we don't know. So that's a very good question. Yeah. Okay, so the question is, okay, it's 10 to the 60th to get the right physical law, the right expansion of the Big Bang, but maybe the Big Bang exploded 10 to the 60th times. Well, the idea of an oscillating universe, of a universe exploding outward and then coming back in together and then exploding outward again, probably the last famous scientist who held that was Carl Sagan in his, I think it was his NOVA series, The Cosmos, a very famous series, very good series to watch. Sagan believed that the universe blew up and then came back together and then blew up and came back together. That theory, the oscillating theory of the cosmos, has been almost entirely put down because what we found is that the universe is expanding and actually accelerating. There's such a thing as dark matter. What is it? If you find out, let me know. Well, nobody knows. It's something that we can't observe that is making the universe accelerate from itself. The other problem with the oscillating theory is that the universe has roughly 1% the amount of mass to draw itself back together. However, even if it did draw itself back together, physicists argue, it wouldn't come back together and be like a basketball hitting a gymnasium floor. Like it comes back in and boom, explodes back out. They describe it as it'd be more like a lump of clay falling and hitting the gym floor and just dudding. You'd need a cause to blow it back out. And so for a number of reasons, the oscillating theory has failed. However, they've replaced that with a new theory called the multiverse theory, which is not that the universe blew up and came back together and blew up and came back together, but that there's actually multiple universes, some of which are in different dimensions and some are just kind of outside the globe of our universe. They're unobservable in principle. But you can see kind of what's going on here. You either need an infinite personal God, or you need the universe to explode and retract an infinite number of times, or you just need an infinite number of universes. But what we see is there needs to be an explanation for this effect that's infinite. An infinite explosion, infinite number of universes, or an infinite creator who can do it. Well, that leads into our next question. Some of the objections raised up here. What about, let's look at some objections to this. What about the anthropic principle? It's not that the universe was created for us. It's that we were created for the universe. It's not that the universe was finally tuned to us. It's that we were finally tuned to the universe through evolution. Well, let's just get into it. Let me read this to you. Paul Davies. Think about it like this. Consider this. Not one of your ancestors died childless. Is that true? That's right. If my dad died childless, I wouldn't exist. If my grandfather had died childless, he wouldn't exist. Okay, think of how many ancestors I've had. My dad, my grandfather, my great-great-grandfather, my great-great-great-grandfather, all the way going back. What are the odds that I would exist? Okay, let's multiply that again. Think of how many sperm you out-competed to get into your mother's egg. Let's say 10 million or whatever. It was you and 9,999,999 other sperm that were trying to get into your mother's egg. You just happened to be the one who made it in. So what you're saying is there was a 10 million to one chance that you survived and the others didn't. So that means, okay, I'm a 10 million to one chance. Let's say I walk up to someone else in this room. They were a 10 million to one chance that they existed. Wait a minute. So the chance that he and I would exist is 10 million to one times 10 million to one. It's just an inconceivable improbability. So what some agnostics and atheists say is that, yeah, the universe is finely tuned and it's astronomically improbable, but the astronomically improbable happens all the time. You're 10 million to one. She's 10 million to one. The fact that we'd all be here, astronomically improbable. Okay, consider this. Not one of your ancestors died childless. What are the odds against this sequence of lucky accidents extending unbroken over billions of years, generation after generation? No human lottery would dare to offer such adverse odds. But here you are, a winner in the great Darwinian game of chance. You see his point. Okay, you happen to be here, but it's just lucky that you're even here. Martin Rees comes back at this and says this. This is in his book, Just Six Numbers. He says, you think this explains the fine-tuning of the universe? This is what he says on page 148. Regarding the anthropic principle, quote, many scientists take this line, but it certainly leaves me unsatisfied. Okay, so Rees doesn't like this. He doesn't think that this is actually a good explanation for what we see in nature. Rees actually thinks that this is a terrible explanation. Well, why does he think it's a bad explanation? Let's look at one point here. The first point is, a life-prohibiting universe would prevent us from being surprised if it wasn't finely tuned. Their point is, if the universe wasn't finely tuned, you wouldn't be here to think about it. I guess that's true. If one of those constants was off, then nobody would be alive to be surprised about it, right? Is that logically true? I think it is. I think that's true. If one of the fine-tuning constants was off, we wouldn't be here to be surprised about it. However, we shouldn't ignore our surprise because we are here and find astronomical odds in our favor. Let me just give you an illustration that might help. Think of it like this. You're fighting for your military and you're behind enemy lines and you get caught, okay, fighting this rebel insurgents in a foreign territory, and they put you in some kind of POW camp and they say, you know, in 6 days we're going to come and we're going to bring a firing squad and we're going to execute you in front of your comrades. So 6 days go by and finally they put a blindfold around your eyes. They tie you up behind your back. They march you up in front of the firing squad. You kind of peek out from underneath your blindfold and you see 100 trained marksmen, all with rifles pointed straight at your heart. Well, just then you hear the enemy leader say, "All right, men, are you ready? Aim, fire," and you just hear this litany of gunshells go off. Boom. You look down. You're still alive. They all missed. You look back against the wall and there's just shells all around your silhouette. Every single one of them missed. So the guy grabs you by the scruff of the neck and he throws you back into the jail cell and he says, "We're going to come back after you tomorrow." So you're laying there in your bunk bed in this POW camp and you're thinking to yourself, what could explain the astronomical odds that I would be alive? You know, maybe all of the marksmen were drunk. Maybe they were just drinking and they all missed. Or, you know, maybe our comrades loaded all of their guns with blanks. I can't be right. I saw all the shells. You know, maybe somebody bribed them and they all missed on purpose. Or maybe, just maybe, they were just having fun with me and wanted to see me wet my pants in front of all of them. So they shot a big silhouette around me just to have fun at my expense. And just then, your skeptical friend in the POW camp leans up to you and he says, "Hey, buddy, I'm trying to get some sleep." You say, "Well, no, I'm trying to explain why I'm still here." And he says to you, "Well, you know what? If one of them hit you, then you wouldn't be here to be surprised about it. So why don't you just shut up and go to bed?" Is that true? If one of the marksmen shot you through the heart, you wouldn't be here to be surprised about it, would you? Does that mean since they all missed that you should neglect your surprise? Does that mean that you'd be able to get to bed that night based on that explanation? Would that explain the astronomical improbability? Absolutely not. While it's true that if the fine-tuning was off, we wouldn't be surprised, that doesn't mean that since we're here and we're witnessing the astronomically improbable, that we should just say, well, we're here, and so if it wasn't right, then we wouldn't be here anyways. Let me give you another illustration, because it's kind of a mind bender. Imagine you're playing poker for $100 a hand. 12 hands go by, and your buddy got 4 aces every single time. Or he got a royal flush every single time. He just cleaned you out $1,200. So you jump up from the table, you grab him by the scruff of the neck, and right before you punch him in the face, he says, whoa, dude. If I hadn't got those cards, you wouldn't be surprised about it. Is that true? If he hadn't got the cards, you wouldn't be surprised? Well, absolutely you wouldn't be surprised. The fact that he did get the cards means that you should be surprised. This argument fails on that point. It's not logically true that if we do see the astronomically improbable, that that's a way of explaining it. Okay, objection number 2. What about the famed multiverse? They theorize that there's multiple different universes, maybe in different dimensions, maybe outside the scope of our universe. Here's the way Brian Greene describes it. Brian Greene is a very popular scientist. He's really good at making science applicable. This is from his book, The Elegant Universe. Page 367, he writes, "If we scan through this huge maze of universes, the vast majority of these universes will not have conditions hospitable to life, or at least to anything remotely akin to life as we know it. So if you look out at the multiverse, there's like an infinite number of universes, and most of them won't have the right fine tuning. Okay, fair enough. In light of the sensitive dependence of life on the details of physics, if we now ask, for instance, why the forces and particles of nature have the particular properties we observe, a possible answer emerges. Okay? Across the entire multiverse, these features vary widely. Their properties can be different and are different in other universes. So, okay, there's 30 different knobs, and maybe in a different universe they're lined up in a different way. Maybe you get up in front of that firing squad of 100 marksmen, ready, aim, fire, you hear the guns go off. Then they take your blindfold off, and you look over, and you see that 99 men have been shot. Well, if there's 100 men out there being killed, then maybe one of you would survive. Well, if there's an infinite number of universes, okay, it's astronomically improbable that one of them would have the right features for life. But if you've got an infinite set, well, then you've got enough to have at least one of them. We just happen to be the lucky one. Stephen Hawking very boldly writes in his book, The Grand Design, the multiverse concept can explain the fine-tuning of physical law without the need for a benevolent creator who made the universe for our benefit. He thinks this can replace God in this equation. Let's see what we think. Number one, I'm sure you were asking yourself, we're surrounded by an infinite number of universes? You mean in like different dimensions? Or maybe beyond the scope of our universe? I was the last to find out. Is that true? Actually, there's not one shred of empirical evidence for a multiverse. Let me repeat that. There's not one shred of empirical evidence for a multiverse. Martin Rees, an ardent multiverse supporter, writes that the multiverse theory is, quote, plainly still more than a tentative hypothesis. That's as good as it is. He admits that, quote, these universes would never be directly observable, even in principle. We couldn't even hope to observe these universes, is what he's saying. And he's a supporter of this view. George Ellis, probably ranking in the top two or three of the world's most eminent cosmologists on Earth. He's from South Africa. In his recent article in Scientific American, he writes this: even if the multiverse exists, it leaves the deep mysteries of nature unexplained. All the parallel universes lie outside our horizon and remain beyond our capacity to see now or ever, no matter how technology evolves. There's no possible way we could observe these other universes, he says. In fact, they're too far away to have had any influence on our universe whatsoever. That is why none of the claims made by multiverse enthusiasts can be directly substantiated. We have no hope of testing it observationally. Now think about that. Why would a group of rational, empirical scientists come up with a theory that's not empirically verifiable? Well, they have to have some explanation for the fine-tuning. This is the best that they have. Number two, we could point out that Occam's razor applies here as well, our philosophical principle from earlier. Occam's razor was that we should not multiply entities beyond what's necessary. Would it make more sense that one creator finely tuned the universe, or that there are an infinite number of universes? Or to put that another way, it seems that to get rid of one creator, you need to replace him with an infinite number of unobservable universes. Here's the way Paul Davies criticizes this view. He says, in the end, it boils down to a question of belief. Is it easier to believe in a cosmic designer than the multiplicity of universes necessary? If we cannot visit the other universes or experience them directly, their possible existence must remain just as much a matter of faith as belief in God. The seemingly miraculous concurrence of numerical values that nature has assigned to her fundamental constants must remain the most compelling evidence for an element of cosmic design. That's from his book, God and the New Physics. So Occam's razor applies here. Number three, the multiverse theory if true, explains too much. Okay, there's no empirical evidence for it whatsoever. We can't even hope to observe these other universes. Occam's razor says that we shouldn't multiply causes beyond necessity. You'd think this thing would be pretty much sunk. Let's give a third point. If the multiverse theory is true, it explains too much. Think about it. The multiverse theory wouldn't just explain this improbability. It would actually explain every improbability you ever find. So let's say you go into a poker game. Again, your buddy cleans you out $1,200, gets 12 royal flushes in a row. You get ready to punch him, and he says, whoa, dude. The probability of getting 12 royal flushes in a row, well, that's really improbable, but, you know, there are an infinite number of universes out there. And, you know, if there are an infinite number of universes, then there's an infinite number of card games being played. And I just happened to be the right one that got 12 royal flushes in a row. What if you found a dead body and it was stabbed 54 times in the back and the spouse is saying, oh, it was a suicide? Well, there are an infinite number of universes, and on an infinite number of universes, a suicide could happen where you get stabbed 55 times in the back by yourself. And we just happen to be in that right one. The multiverse theory explains too much. If there's an infinite number of universes, then nothing would be improbable. You couldn't just apply it to the universe having been finely tuned for life. You'd have to apply it to every other improbability. Here's the way John Lennox, this is a Christian, he's an Oxford mathematician. I like him a lot, actually. This is from his book, Gunning for God. He says, I am tempted to add that belief in God seems an infinitely more rational option if the alternative is to believe that every other universe that can possibly exist does exist, including one in which Richard Dawkins is the Archbishop of Canterbury, Christopher Hitchens the Pope, and Billy Graham has just been voted Atheist of the Year. But wait a minute, if there's an infinite number of universes, then that is not just probably true, it's certainly true, given an infinite set. We're not even going to go into the problems with actual infinities. All right, what about number three? Objection number three. Objection number three is, who designed God? I have come across this objection in just about every book I read on the subject from skeptics and atheists. This seems to be like the packing punch that they will pull out to really bring a smackdown on this argument. Well, if God finely tuned the universe, then who finely tuned God? Well, if the universe is improbable, okay, it is improbable. But a cause, a designer of the universe, would be infinitely more improbable than the universe itself. Here's the way Sam Harris describes it in his book, Letter to a Christian Nation. Any being capable of creating a complex world promises to be very complex himself. Any being capable of creating a complex world would have to be complex. So if we want something improbable, we might as well just go with the universe rather than with God. He's got to be more complex. Christopher Hitchens in his book, God is Not Great. Thus, the postulate of a designer or a creator only raises the unanswerable question of who designed the designer or who created the creator. Religion and theology have consistently failed to overcome this objection. Seems like every skeptical book you read, they will have this objection. How do we respond to it? Number one, if we had to explain every explanation, this would never end. Any of you have kids or babysit kids? When you give them answers, what do they always say? Why? 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 Remember last week we were talking about that. You know, why do we have to go to the store? Well, because we have to eat. Why do we have to eat? Because we'll starve to death. Why? Well, what if they just kept asking why ad infinitum, ad nauseum, all the way infinitely? Whatever you give an explanation for, they just ask why. Why? Eventually, you would have to have a stopping point. If every explanation you had needed an explanation itself, this would never end. Think about it like this. Imagine if some archaeologists found artifacts from a lost tribe. A bunch of artifacts laid out there. Well, a skeptic comes up and says, well, who was this lost tribe left these artifacts? I don't know. I have no idea, but there must have been some lost tribe that did it. Well, if you can't explain who or what or when the lost tribe is or was, well, then I'm not going to accept that as an explanation for these artifacts. What? Just because we don't know about the lost tribe, that can still be an adequate explanation for those artifacts. What if 100 people came in to see Dr. Gregory House? He's canceled, but some other doctor, okay? And they all have the same symptoms. And some medical doctor says, okay, vomiting, bleeding from the eyes, and whatever else. Vomiting, bleeding from the eyes, whatever else. And they all have the exact same symptoms. Would it be rational to believe that there was a common virus that was causing all those sicknesses in those 100 people? Of course it would. Well, can you explain the virus? No, I can't explain the virus. I'm just looking at the effect. I know that there must be some common cause. Or imagine if we went to Mars and we found signs of civilization. We don't know what alien race left it there, but something must have left it there. This is really confusing, the nature of explanation. Number two, if God is more complex than the universe, this doesn't mean he is less probable. Now, most theologians would disagree with this. They would claim that God is very simple, not complex. God is an unembodied mind, not a series of parts. God is not a Ford car that has a bunch of combustible parts. God is an unembodied mind. He's simple in his very nature. But let's exclude that for a second. Let's exclude the definition of God. Let's just say God is more complex than the universe. This doesn't mean that he's less probable. Think of an example. Imagine if you came up to a painting and two people walk in. One person says, I think that that painting just happened because the paint fell off the shelf and it splattered up on the canvas. It just happened to go that way. Somebody else says, well, I don't think that makes any sense. I think probably a artist came in here and painted that painting. There's a boat, there's a kid, seashore. An artist must be responsible. An artist is responsible for that? Do you have any idea how improbable it is that an artist would evolve from evolution? Oh, that's incredibly improbable. You know, it's like billions to one that we could have an artist evolve in that case. You know, an artist is actually far more complex than that painting. I mean, he would be composed of cells, a central nervous system, and an eye and hand to be able to move and to act and to actually create a painting. Well, is that true? Is the artist more complex than the painting? Of course he is more complex. Does that mean that that's not a probable explanation for the painting? Of course not. It is a probable explanation, way better than the alternative. There were a number of students, friends of mine, who took a class at OSU. It was a very interesting class. I can't remember the name of it, but the class was set up in such a way where there was an atheist and a Christian in the class, and throughout the 10 weeks they debated over the existence of God. So you hear the atheist philosopher explain his view, and the Christian philosopher come back and give his view. Very cool class. The problem was, when they got to the subject of fine-tuning, the atheist philosopher came forward and said, I think that this is really powerful evidence for God. Michael Shermer, arch-skeptic, thinks that this is the best evidence for God out there. He said, but you know, if I'm going to have a brute fact, I'd rather just have the brute fact of a complex universe rather than the brute fact of a creator. And that's my stopping point. You have your stopping point. I have my stopping point. Well, a bunch of my friends came back to me after that class and they said, you know, this is what the atheist said. And I said, well, what did the Christian say? And the Christian said, yeah, I guess that's true. I guess that's your brute fact and my brute fact is God. I was livid. I couldn't believe that was his awful response to that argument. Fine-tuning cannot be explained away as a brute fact. This confuses the cause with the effect. How do we explain this effect, a finely tuned universe? Well, we're not going to give a cause for it. We're just going to repeat the effect. The explanation is the thing in question. You know, imagine if you were in SETI, the SETI project, Search for Extraterrestrial Life. You're sitting there with your buddy and a binary code comes through. You read the code. And what the code says is, hi, how are you doing on Earth? we're an alien species from Alpha Centauri. We're going to come and visit you really soon. Hope you're doing well. And that's the end of the transmission. Okay, and this really was from Alpha Centauri. It wasn't from Earth. Okay, and you turn to your buddy and you're like, that needs to be explained. How could that binary code come together and give a message like that? And your friend says, well, you know, the cause of that could be an alien race, or it could just be random binary code. If I need to have a brute fact, I might as well just take the binary code rather than the cause of the alien race. That would be ridiculous. We don't need to hear the question repeated. Why is there a binary code? We need an explanation, a cause for that effect. You can't just repeat the problem. You can't say that the effect is the effect itself. You need to give a cause for the effect. Otherwise, the principle of sufficient reason breaks down. Modern science goes out the window. We no longer have to explain why things are the way that they are. Well, before I wrap up with some conclusions, do we have any questions? Yeah. Yeah, so the question is, what about string theory? How does this relate to it? Even the idea of string theory, the concept in intelligent design is not just that things are complex or astronomical, but that they fit an independent pattern. They call it specified complexity. It was kind of coined by Bill Dembski. He's the guy who kind of came up with it, although it preceded him. He kind of was the one who popularized it. It's not just that things are complex, but that they fit an independent pattern. So a kid going up to a keyboard, typing in random letters, that's actually incredibly astronomically improbable, whatever set he comes up with. If there's 1 through 26 letters on the keyboard and he's typing in a specific set, even if it's gibberish, that's really improbable, but it's not specified. In order for it to be specified, it has to fit an independent pattern. In the case of the organization of the universe, what we need is not just the laws that are improbable, but they have to fit a specified complexity. Namely, being life-permitting, not life-prohibiting. So with the idea of string theory, which is a very speculative field of science, let's not even go there, but it's very speculative, you'd still have to account for why string theory is fitting an independent pattern, namely to be life-promoting, not life-prohibiting. So even if that is somehow factored in there, why is it lining up perfectly for life, even if it explains the mind of God, as Stephen Hawking puts it. Yeah, up here. Okay, the question is, what is a new atheist? Well, atheism has been around since the Enlightenment, in fact, earlier, but very popularized in the Enlightenment. In the last, sociologists place it around the time of 9/11, actually, when religion reached its utmost depravity in the eyes of the Western world. Not that religion wasn't worse before then, but right around the time of the early 2000s, there became this phenomenon called the New Atheism, which was a group of men. There's actually four of them: Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Christopher Hitchens, and Sam Harris. They're called the Four Horsemen of the New Atheism. That's their self-designation. One of whom passed away about a year ago, Christopher Hitchens. There's only three. They came on the scene, and they had been writing books before. Richard Dawkins had written The Blind Watchmaker and River Out of Eden and all these different books. But really around the 2000s, right around the time of 9/11, that kind of galvanized atheism into arguing that religion is not just false. You're not just a fool for believing in God, but religion is evil. And to believe in God is not just wrong intellectually, it's wrong morally. And so they began to argue that belief in God was wrong on that basis. You can see why, because the Western world was kind of stunned by 9/11. Many sociologists believe that that was kind of the cause of the new atheism. So a lot of these arguments are not new. Most of them are not. They're very old, but they're kind of bringing in the sucker punch of you're not just wrong, but you're evil for believing in God. So that's a good question. That's what the new atheism is. Well, let's wrap up. I want to go home and see my wife. Number one. Conclusions. Number one, if God is really there, we don't get to pick what he's like. I hope you see that based on this evidence. I think studying the cosmos, physical law, physics, one of the things that this does, at least for me, is it makes me feel really small in comparison with the universe. the way that the psalmist describes it in Psalm 8 is he says, when I think about the universe and the work of your hands, what is man that you even think of us? It does make us feel really small. Compared to a God like that, you know, we don't get to pick what he's like. However, if you're here with us tonight and you feel like you're kind of struggling with faith, I guess I would just tell you what Jesus said in Matthew 17:20 is that you don't need to have perfect 100% faith to come to know God. The Bible disagrees with that. The way Jesus put it is you just need a mustard seed of faith. One time, Jesus was talking to a guy who was not sure if he believed in him or not. It's in Mark 9. And the guy was saying, you know, Jesus, can you heal my son? And Jesus said, yeah, I can heal your son if you have faith. And the guy turned to Jesus and famously he said, I believe, I just help me with my unbelief. And Jesus did not say, well, go home until you can get some good faith and come back. Jesus said to him, your son is healed. He healed his son right there. So if you're here with us tonight and you feel like you want to have faith, what God's calling on you to do is not have perfect 100% faith in him. Instead, just to call out to him with kind of an open heart and just say, God, you know, if you're there, I want to know you. I want to know you because you're the God of the universe who created all this. Well, why don't we pray down? Let's have a few people pray. And if you want to pray that just in the quiet of your heart, you can do that. And I'll close up for us. Yeah, God, as we look through this material, one of the things that we see is that there is some room for interpretation. You haven't made your existence just overwhelming, but you've made yourself hidden enough that if we don't want to ever know you, we don't have to. We can push you away, and you've given us free will. But, Lord, we've seen here tonight that you have given sufficient evidence. It's strong. It's definitely persuasive in my mind. And, God, we just pray for anyone here tonight who maybe is feeling the same way, that maybe they're kind of reassessing what they do believe. And we pray that they would just have the courage to call out to you in the quiet of their heart to come to know you. We know that your word says that anyone who calls on your name will not be disappointed. And we can all agree with that, too. We pray these things in your son's name. Amen.